In dieser zweiten Axiom-Sendung Wissenschaft, Wissen auf Radio X folgen jetzt eben das Interview mit Alina Serban über die Ausstellung Indirect Speech und dann eben das Gespräch mit Susan Buckmores.
The exhibition is called Indirect Speech, and it's within this program of Kuratorn Workshop 5 days until the end of art. And my exhibition is the third one in this series of five. And the exhibition will open on 2nd of September and will last till 29th of October this year.
Yeah. And indirect speech, what is
yeah,
the
so,
meaning?
Yeah, so the project Indirect Speech starts from the idea how to translate things within the field of art. So in a way it has a connection with Benjamin. You asked me about this, in the sense that Benjamin was talking about languages and their translation, and he said that the translation is not doing between the language, but within the language.
Yeah.
So he talks about art, music, sculpture, and all this in the sense they are the language of practice.
Yeah.
But the translation between them, they are not doing between these fields, but within them. So the exhibition, it's dealing with this, how to translate things inside the field of art. So, for example, the basic question that I would like to ask to answer from the works I'm going to present is what is happening between these two elements, what is being said and what is being presented. So this gap between the two processes, which are part of the art practice, will be shown in the exhibition by the artist that I'm inviting in. So it's in a way a project which deals with a more like personal approach to the art process, and it deals with insecurity, uncertainty, and the impossibility to, in a way, to translate fully this meaning. What you says, what you say now, and what you present in the end as a result of your practice. So this is the layout, the frame of the exhibition. And the inviting artists are Nevin Aladag. She was born in Turkey, but she lives now in Berlin. And her work will be a video which is called Voice Over, and deals with cultural translation from a more social and political context. It's a video which talks about emigrants, Turkish emigrant which lives now in Berlin, but which are remembering things which belongs to their past in their country. It's about a song, the story. And there is another artist, which is Viktor Alimpiev. He comes from Russia, and he lives in Moscow and works there, and he will have a work which was produced in collaboration with Oka Centrum in Linz, and it's called What is the Name of the Platz? So, Wie heißt der Platz? So, and it's basically a story theatrically constructed in one room, like theater and ballet, but in a way it deals with the question how you can translate things in a public space, how you can address to the people in a public context. And then it's an interesting work of a Romanian artist. She's called Ioana Nemes. She lives in Bucharest, and her work is dealing with a private diary. And this private diary is constructed around some individual and personal texts, which she put in different formats. And in this exhibition will be presented in two rooms, like two big texts, where she chose a day of her life, and she explained it through this text. Of the text is chose like an intermediary to transmit what she felt in that moment. It's a installation, and I hope will look very nice.
Yeah.
And then it's another work of a Romanian artist, Ciprian Mureșan. He lives now in Cluj, and the work is called Das Schloss, and from Kafka, and the work consists in his writing the end of the Kafka's book in German. So, and this will be presented like a sound installation.
Yeah.
So, and somebody will speak the end of the Kafka Das Schloss. It's like a sound installation, and the object, of course, where he makes to a real book the end of the book.
Yeah, and he is able to write in German.
He will write in Romanian and will translate it.
Ah, yeah, okay.
It will be like a German translation of the text. So, yeah, and then. There is another artist which lives now in Sweden, in Stockholm. His name is Stefan Constantinescu, and his piece is called Ophelia's Death.
Yeah.
And he takes as a point of departure the Millet painting of Ophelia.
Yeah.
And he somehow translated this, his for him like a sort of obsessive reference. And he's translating this in another medium, which is like a 3D animation. But his work is dealing with the idea of between copy and original. How real can you do the reality by choosing a medium to translate this? And this is like a 3D animation.
3D?
Yeah, animation, like but model, three-dimensional animation, not like classical bande dessinée, but it's like doing with the digital.
Yeah. Okay.
And.
Yeah, indirect speech. Ab dem 2. September in Kassel im Museum Fridericianum. Monteverdi ist Teil der Performance des Calliope Ratins, das im Museum für Kommunikation dann Monteverdis Liebesmadrigalen aus dem 8. Madrigalbuch und sein Musiktheater Il Combattimento di Tancredi e Clorinda dann im Rahmen der Konferenz Now, das Jetzt der Erkennbarkeit, Orte Walter Benjamins in Kultur, Kunst und Wissenschaft vorstellen wird. Und wir hören jetzt noch einen Ausschnitt über das dämonische Berlin und dann im Anschluss eben Susan Backmoss.
Ich werde heute mit einem Erlebnis beginnen, das in mein 14. Jahr fällt. Damals war ich Schüler auf einem Internat. Wie das in solchen Anstalten üblich ist, versammelten sich Kinder und Lehrer allwöchentlich abends mehrere Male und es wurde musiziert, eine Rede gehalten oder aus einem Dichter vorgelesen. Eines Abends hielt der Musiklehrer die Kapelle, wie man diese Abendversammlung nannte. Das war ein kleiner, putziger Mann von unvergesslichem Ausdruck in den ernsten Augen, mit der spiegelsten Glatze, die ich je sah, um die ein halboffener Kranz scharf geringelten, dunklen Lockenhaares stand. Sein Name ist unter den deutschen Musikliebhabern bekannt. Er hieß August Halm. Dieser August Halm kam in die Kapelle, um uns Geschichten von E.T.A. Hoffmann vorzulesen, eben dem Dichter, von dem ich zu euch sprechen will. Ich weiß nicht mehr, was der Musiklehrer las. Es kommt auch gar nicht darauf an. Desto genauer habe ich einen einzigen Satz aus der Ansprache im Sinn behalten, mit dem er seine Vorlesung einleitete. Er kennzeichnete Hoffmanns Vorliebe für das Bizarre, das Schrullige, Geisterhafte, Unerklärliche. Ich glaube, was Herr Halm sagte, war sehr danach angetan, uns Kinder auf die nachfolgenden Geschichten zu spannen. Dann aber schloss er mit diesem Satz, den ich bis heute nicht vergessen habe. Wozu einer solche Geschichten schreibt, das werde ich euch nächstens einmal erzählen. Auf dieses nächstens warte ich immer noch. Und da Herr Halm inzwischen gestorben ist, müsste mich diese Erklärung auf so unheimliche Weise erreichen, dass ich beschließe, ihr zuvorzukommen. So versuche ich heute, euch gegenüber ein Versprechen einzulösen, das mir gegeben wurde, als ich so jung war wie ihr. Wenn ich ein bisschen mogeln wollte, könnte ich es mir mit der Sache leicht machen. Ich brauchte nur statt des Wortes »wozu« zu setzen »warum«. Und die Antwort wäre sehr einfach. Warum schreibt ein Dichter? Aus 1000 Gründen. Weil es ihm Spaß macht, sich etwas auszudenken. Oder weil solche Vorstellungen, solche Bilder von ihm Besitz ergreifen, dass er sich erst beruhigen kann, wenn er sie niedergeschrieben hat. Oder weil er sich mit Fragen und Zweifeln herumträgt, für die er eine Art Lösung in den Schicksalen von erdichteten Menschen findet. Oder einfach, weil er schreiben gelernt hat. Oder, das ist leider ein sehr häufiger Fall, weil er überhaupt nichts gelernt hat. Aha.
Ja, verehrte Unsichtbare, Susan Buckmores ist Professorin für politische Philosophie und Sozialtheorie am Department of Government an der Cornell University. Sie ist bekannt geworden durch Arbeiten eben über das Passagenwerk von Walter Benjamin, über die Dialektik des Sehens und auch über die Art und Weise, wie sie eben die Traumbilder und Katastrophen sozusagen zusammenbringt und jetzt in einer aktuellen Veröffentlichung auch versucht, nach dem 11. September Islam und Terrorismus einzubeziehen in eine sich globalisierte Welt. Sie beginnt damit zu erzählen, wie sie nach Frankfurt gekommen ist.
I actually came to Germany the first time to study Hermann Hesse. I was a totally non-political person.
Hi.
And I went to Tübingen to study Hermann Hesse, and it was, I think, 1969, and this was not what people were interested in. And so the choice was between doing the project I had gotten the stipendium to do or doing what was relevant to my generation of students in Germany, and so I chose the second very guiltily, but fortunately I chose the second. So I read Adorno. He just died that year.
Yeah.
And I began to read Adorno, and Ernst Bloch was still alive in Tübingen, and I had a kind of introduction to the Frankfurter Schule.
Yeah.
And then I went back to the States to start my doctorate program, and it was very funny because at that time my own dissertation advisor had become a Marxist, and I had too.
So at the same time.
Common, although he himself was Palestinian and did not speak German, he was happy to have me go back to Germany and work on the Frankfurter Schule.
Yeah.
And Martin Jay had just finished his book.
Yeah.
So there was something of a roadmap. And when I got to Frankfurt, I just had a really terribly interesting time. Habermas was still there, and students were living in Kommune, and I was in the Rot-Gold-Kommune, das war Kronberger Straße 28. Ich habe da gewohnt, and then I started to study. And at that time also Rolf Tiedemann was beginning to collect the archives. And so he was extremely helpful making materials available to me, because they were not in any public place.
Yeah.
And so I began then and wrote to my dissertation on Adorno. But this character, Benjamin, who was so intriguing, he kept being somehow more interesting to me than Adorno. Adorno was very much still in the tradition of philosophy as a discipline.
Yeah,
And Benjamin was way out of that, into all kinds of incompatible directions. And it was the time when Gershom Scholem was fighting with Adorno, who was fighting with the kind of Marxist heritage of Benjamin. You know, to whom did he belong? You know, Benjamin kept, of course, he was only being discussed in a very posthumous way with very partial publications at that time. But I just found him fascinating.
Yeah.
And even though he was so idiosyncratic, you had the sense that he was speaking more universally.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, I found that when I started teaching both Adorno and Benjamin, it was Benjamin who spoke to my students in the United States, you know, in the 1980s and 90s. It was Benjamin who was more interesting somehow.
Yeah.
So my interest shifted, but recently also I've come back to Adorno, and I appreciate very much his philosophical depth. It really is impressive. However, it's Benjamin who speaks to our own time.
To who? Who speaks to?
Our own time.
About his own time?
No, who speaks to us in our time. I mean,
ah, okay.
He's much more contemporary, much more
actual. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So probably I should read that question in German.
Yeah, okay.
And maybe that's then the second question. Also in Ihrem ersten Buch, The Origin of Negative Dialectics, haben Sie sich sowohl mit Adorno als auch mit Benjamin befasst. Der Schwerpunkt Ihrer Untersuchung lag damals auf Adornos negativer Dialektik als philosophischer Methode. Ihre spätere Arbeit, The Dialectics of Seeing, war dagegen allein dem Werk Benjamins gewidmet. Im Jahr 2000 haben Sie in Dreamworld and Catastrophes die benjaminsche Methode verwendet, um das politische, beispielsweise utopische Potenzial von der Traumwelt der Massenkultur im 20. Jahrhundert herauszustellen, beispielsweise genauer zu retten. In Ihrer intellektuellen Entwicklung lässt sich daher ein wachsendes Interesse für Benjamins Denken bemerken. Halten Sie Benjamins Methode für fruchtbarer hinsichtlich der politisch-kulturellen Gegenwart als die Methode Adornos?
Auf der anderen Seite muss man sagen, dass mein Benjamin nicht der einzige Benjamin ist. Es gibt Leute, also Scholars, besonders hier in den Vereinigten Staaten, die total nicht, die stimmen nicht zu mit was ich dann aus die Methode Benjamin, die benjaminischen Methode artikuliere.
Yeah. Oh, if you like, you can answer in English.
Yes, maybe it's easier. But the Benjaminian method is for me, I'm not sure anymore how much of it is me and how much of it is Benjamin. I do know that many people don't agree with the way I use him, the way I see him as a visual thinker. That was one of the first criticisms, that because there are not that many images in his work.
Yeah.
Wanted to see him as a literary writer. They talked about him in the same breath with Hölderlin or Goethe or any one of a number of bourgeois literary figures. And my interest in the visual was not popular. And I must say, even today is I can ask.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to say that I find his method fruitful if I've invented his method to a certain degree. But I do feel that I am faithful to the spirit.
Yeah.
Benjamin, perhaps more so than those who bring him back into the more classical German or European literary traditions.
Yeah.
The ostrich in the skyclap. The chop is a partial object that quasi wants its beer. I'd bring the profession of the second chance. It's time to clear.
Worin sehen Sie die Aufgabe des heutigen kritischen Intellektuellen in Bezug auf jene Massenmedien, die sich seit Benjamins Zeit eben weiterentwickelt und verbreitet haben? Wie verhält sich das auf die, wie würden Sie da die aktuelle Massenkultur verstehen?
Well, I think this is a question that has intellectuals actually all over the world wondering about. The first time I really was aware of how difficult the problem could be was when I was working together with Moscow philosophers. And during that period of time, the Soviet Union ended. And they were left with this question as to who their audience was. With whom were they writing? And I think also Eastern Germans felt something of the same thing. Somehow the structure of their own public sphere had disappeared, and nothing had really replaced it. And they didn't want it to be a nationalist kind of replacement. We don't really know. I mean, particularly because if we, particularly in the United States, have a great advantage speaking English and for global distribution, we have an enormous advantage over other cultures to get published, let's say, in translation in Japan or Korea or other places or China. And yet, that if you do get that kind of translation, you don't know how to evaluate it. Yeah. I cannot believe that the proportions of translations are a true representation of the intelligence of what's being published. Probably very, very important things are being published in very obscure languages that none of us are capable of reading. So you can't even say, well, I've had success in reaching a global audience. You don't even know what that means. So it's difficult to write. And as a matter of fact, I think the best, you can't do it by thinking about marketing or, you know, the actual effect, right? You have to write with a kind of, sometimes for me, it's thinking of generations to come. In other words, I write for the people who survive us.
Yeah.
And in my culture particularly, it's those who survive us.
Yeah.
Because you can see someone like Benjamin in a very dark hour, and the United States is not quite that dark, but it's rather dim. You write for a future, and therefore you can't judge anything by contemporary success. So the intellectual is really, really faced with a problem. Because, for instance, if you're an artist and you do work and you do it for a global public, well, that's just like saying you've entered the global art world, which is extremely manipulated. Mm. And I think actually really turned into such a commercial business, that it actually makes it difficult to be a good artist rather than easier. So, I mean, it's all very, very problematic as far as what we're trying to do, how we're trying to work together. Again, I think a lot of the collaborative work is done in isolation.
Yeah.
It can't be done simply by having international meetings. It's done by people struggling through on their own, but then saying something that somehow gets beyond the ways we're presently thinking. And then the problem is that maybe that, precisely that, won't be picked up. But I'll tell you personally what I'm convinced about.
Yeah.
That the money I'm making by my private property ownership,
okay,
intellectual production service, is nothing. That is idiocy. And so I can afford to give up the few thousand dollars a year that I get in order to make that free. And one thing I'm doing this summer, actually, is working with a student to get a web page with a lot of materials that can be downloaded for free.
That's right.
Because book publishers have such trouble still with images. But desktop publishing, PDF files, PowerPoint, all of these tools allow one to use images very easily. And you, of course, have to be careful about the copyright on the image.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, I think that's an extremely important avenue of intellectual work.
Yeah.
Similarly, bitch, the brick irritant, the style. Reason is, you tend to defense of the object. Ego, words, one of the only ways of losing knowledge. A bourgeois symptom expelled.
Ja, Kunst ist vorbei. Die Zeit der Kunst, meint Susan Buckmores. Wenn man sich da nochmal Benjamins Idee der Aura anschaut, die Dinge sich näher zu bringen, die Entschälung des Gegenstandes aus seiner Hülle. Die Zertrümmerung der Aura ist die Signatur einer Wahrnehmung, deren Sinn für das Gleichartige in der Welt so gewachsen ist, dass sie mittels der Reproduktion auch dem Einmaligen abgewinnt. Die Ausrichtung der Realität auf die Massen und der Massen auf sie ist ein Vorgang von unbegrenzter Tragweite, sowohl für das Denken wie für die Anschauung. Das Kunstwerk ist nach Benjamin immer schon reproduzierbar gewesen. Wir nicht. Aber die technische Reproduktion des Kunstwerks ist eben etwas Neues, das sich dann in der Geschichte intermittierend in weit auseinanderliegenden Schüben, aber mit wachsender Intensität durchsetzt. Ja, was dann die Aura ist im Zeitalter des Internets, das haben wir ja gerade gehört. Also es ist auf jeden Fall kollaborative Arbeit und es ist Arbeit. Das ist, glaube ich, eines der größten Probleme. Jetzt hören wir noch weiter. Susan Backmaus.
Ideas are not property, and what you want is for any kind of intellectual creativity, you want credit.
Yeah.
Money. You want to be acknowledged as the source.
Yeah.
And that's what it's always been for scholarship, and somehow or other it became something different when the possibilities of its dissemination became so much greater. But I really am very much in favor of fighting against this.
Yeah.
I do think that when they talk to people like us who, you know, we have a job, we have a guaranteed salary, and to make us feel that, you know, oh, we have to be protective of our private intellectual property. This is pure ideology. It is purely to keep us in line. It's control. I'm really very strong on this, and I would not, of course, advocate breaking the law. Far from it. But I think we should fight the law.
Yeah. But on the other hand, this is the market for the next generation in which they will work and. Yeah, they have to have their income in the labor market.
Yes, no, that's true. That's true. If you're a full-time a person, you know, if I were to quit my job and only do web pages and web my own work on a web publication, obviously I couldn't live. But you know, I'm also there's going to be some breakthrough where if people do keep private property, royalties and income, they'll put it in a common bank, which can be drawn on by younger people to start them out. There's many ways you could socialize part of the process, but to let it be seen as purely same as material property, and use that metaphor against the technological possibilities is crazy.
Yeah. That's right. Ah, da könnte man auch zur nächsten Frage kommen, nämlich in Bezug darauf, wie die Massenmedien, wie man heute Massenmedien verwenden kann, wenn um jener sinnlichen, einfühlenden und leiblichen Erfahrung willen die Ästhetik genannt wird, die sie auch Ästhetik nennen. Und das ist ja die Anästhesie, ist ja in dem Sinne fast der gleiche Wortstamm wie Ästhetik und diese Betäubung der Wahrnehmungsfähigkeiten, was kann man denn dieser Anästhetik dann entgegensetzen? Also wenn man, oder kann man das in Bezug auf die heutigen Massenmedien gar nicht mehr sagen? Das Internet kann ja wesentlich aktiver genutzt werden als jetzt die passiven Medien, wie zum Beispiel Kino oder Fernsehen und so weiter.
Well, no, I did write about this aesthetics turning into anesthetics because of a kind of swamping of a kind of overwhelming of the senses, which is the kind of reality of mediated experience and the endless number of images and advertisements, etc., that we are exposed to, but. Although I don't think it's simply a question of the internet being interactive or something that you can be much more a producer as opposed to a consumer about, it seems to me that, let's go back to the image, I work with. I mean, the fact that you can pull an image down from the web,
yeah,
and you can put it into a presentation,
yeah,
kind of way of thinking. It's not that you are taking someone's picture that they produced. It's not, you're not using it as an artwork. You're using it as a tool of thought.
Yeah.
And I even think that cinema is developing this capacity to instruct us in technical ways, in forms of thought itself. I'm working with Sokurov films. I don't know if they should. I know the Moloch played in Germany, and I think Sansa.
Yeah.
So, and they're very controversial, but I'm interested in why they're controversial and what is it that he does when he edits his films that produce certain effects that are political in nature, and why are they understood in a negative light by the left, by the liberal left, surely.
Yeah.
So I think that we're much more interested in that, even when it comes to the propaganda that we get about our own governments. You will find, for instance, on CNN, not only a presentation of the propaganda, but a commentary on the propaganda way of being. In other words, we're no longer naive.
Yeah.
We know it's staged. We know it's a photo opportunity.
Yeah.
We know that it was done because a little election is coming up. And this is said in public, so it's not the same as pure propaganda. There's already a kind of, it's often very cynical, but a kind of reflection that goes on. And then I think we become we have a kind of skill which I think can translate into a great deal more positive effect of these media, including the older ones, cinema, etc.
Yeah.
I'm really convinced of that. I'm feeling it myself. You know? And the thing is that what's changed is you don't have a collective audience to simply receive. And indeed, one of the problems is you have so much fragmentation of audience. For instance, it'd be a global intellectual, but you're not reaching billions and billions of people. And as someone said, you can be globally humanist, but you're really terrible to the person next door.
Yeah.
You know, so you miss this kind of local effect very often. And that's a real drawback. That's a drawback. But I still think that the creative possibilities, in other words, even though in a certain way politics is much more dismal right now for me in the United States, my optimism is much greater.
Ja. Ja, da schließt sich die Frage nach der politischen Praxis tatsächlich an. Und da wäre die Frage, ob Sie glauben, wie damals eben Benjamin, dass die Bestimmung dann von Kollektiv, beispielsweise politisch sinnvollen Zielen, auch von einer Auseinandersetzung mit der Vergangenheit und ihren Wünschen notwendig abhängt. Oder glauben Sie eben, dass normative Ressourcen, die die Aktualität der Gegenwart prägen, an sich schon genug sind hinsichtlich dann eben der Entwicklung?
Oh, no, I'm absolutely, you know, it was my first field of study, history.
Yeah.
And I'm absolutely committed to a historical dimension for any analysis. I mean, there is a book actually written in French by a woman named Monzan, called Image, Icon, Economy.
Yeah.
And she is the one who's gotten me interested in the connection between Byzantine iconoclasm and the world of CNN today. Just that distancing, even, and it's not our own lifetime by a long shot to go back to Byzantium, but this historical dimension does fascinating things to one's capacity to think. And if you stay on the level of abstract moral theory or international law or even kind of ontological philosophy, or I would say also psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
But rather, you in other words, if you those approaches that lack a concern for collective history,
yeah,
it seems to me lose an enormous capacity capacity for critical reflection. And there, you have to say that Benjamin who was accused of being a positivist by Adorno in one correspondence. Benjamin, to me, saves himself from that kind of positivism precisely because of this dimension of history.
That
he's always, always interested in as ur forms of the present. It's a very powerful idea. It works. It works in its own investigation.
Yeah. Da kann man tatsächlich dann auch darauf kommen, welche Aufgabe der kritischen Theorie, der aktuellen kritischen Theorie zukommen könnte. Und also das, was sozusagen in den gegenwärtigen gesellschaftlichen Zuständen dann als selbstverständlich gilt, als etwas monströs Fremdartiges erscheinen zu lassen. Also ein solcher Schock oder Überraschung dann zu bewirken, das hielt Benjamin für die eigentliche Aufgabe des kritischen Theoretikers. Und da wäre die Frage, ob Sie sagen würden, dass das immer noch auch für die aktuelle kritische Theorie gilt, oder hat sich diese Aufgabe der kritischen Theorie verändert, also dieser Schock oder die Überraschung
It's
zu bewirken?
Really an interesting question. It's a very interesting question. You know, I think I can't answer it directly, but I'll answer it indirectly by saying that the greatest shock, of the present is the fact that Western development is a minority position.
In a minority?
Yes. I mean by that, if you take the, quote, developed world, the first world that we spoke about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's a minority fringe area compared with the dynamism of China or India. We are a backwater. We will be a backwater, I think, by the end of the 21st century. And, you know, it doesn't mean that we won't be a charming place to visit. But what really matters will not be taking place in Europe or North America, it's my feeling. It gives us a certain freedom. But also an enormous responsibility to decline graciously. I don't think anyone doubted Benjamin's time.
Yeah.
Surely the Soviets did not. That the Western form of development, industrialization and everything that went with it, urbanization, etc., the wave of the future, and the advanced countries were those in the West, or westernized, were the ones that had gone furthest in this direct history. And I think that beginning with the ecology movement in the 70s, that became not at all self-evident.
Yeah.
And the change begins there, but it goes on in many, many ways. I mean, when I think of the moral judgment that could be made in the situation today in Iraq, when you compare the United States and the Iraqis, I would even say Al Qaeda. You know, morally, there is not a high ground for the United States. It simply does not exist. So there's this kind of self. It's racially based to a certain degree, and it's a kind of arrogance that goes along with material comfort. But this idea that we are the best, or that even, you know, and the United States is particularly guilty of this, but Western Europe as well, that, you know, everyone wants to be where we are. I haven't gone yet, but everyone I know is going to Shanghai, and they come back quite humbled.
Humbled.
So, I mean, this is, and, you know, if you take Western Europe and the United States, that's a billion people. And if you take China, that's more than a billion people, and you know, I mean, so we're just a little we're a little part. Yeah, the Muslim world is a billion people, and these transnational collectives, regional collectives, even, are extremely dynamic right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we just have to listen a lot more than we have us.
Yeah.
I teach a course on Islamism, and it's...
Yeah, that's right. That would be the next question. Aber eigentlich erst in Bezug auf die Radiosendung. Vielleicht können Sie, worüber wir bis jetzt noch nicht wirklich gesprochen haben, also zwar über die Medien und über die kritische Theorie, aber die Beziehung der Kultur zu einer politischen Kultur, wo würden Sie sagen, welchen Einfluss hat Kultur auf die Bestimmung und die Formation dann auch politischen Handelns? Also gerade wenn wir in einer minoritären Position sind, trotz der weltweiten Migrationsbewegung, das muss man ja auch versuchen mit einzubeziehen, Transmigration and Transnational Process.
There's one thing that Benjamin was very clear, I would say for him more than others, and that is that the culture that he was studying, if it's about cultural studies, was not a German one. It had to do with modernity, in the sense of industrialization, urbanization, whatever. And it was absolutely not cultural in the anthropological sense. That's really extraordinary when you think about it.
Yeah.
It made no appeal to cultural traditions in the sense of a national culture. None at all. And of course, this notion of culture is very different from multiculturalism, very different. Even postmodernism treats culture as multicultural.
Yeah.
But the idea that technology produces the culture,
yeah,
and that culture is one that we all participate in, with a kind of equality. That's very specific to someone like Benjamin or a certain kind of critical theorist.
Yeah.
Now we've lost that in a way. We've lost that capacity to produce a kind of discourse that would be global and not consider itself culture specific.
Yeah.
And in a way, you know, people have been blaming multiculturalism for this. In other words, that was really a step backwards. Start, you know, talking in terms of everyone's identity being different. Each could have their own voice, et cetera. But it's easier said than done to acknowledge different perspectives and at the same time not lapse into a notion of difference, which is way too limiting and too isolating.
Yeah.
And somehow or other, it didn't feel like a problem to Benjamin's generation. And I count with him here the avant-garde cinema makers, the avant-garde artists. I mean, they had no problem with seeking for humanity in general. They didn't think it was limited.
Yeah.
In the ways that we're terribly concerned about now.
Yeah. Und verehrte Unsichtbare, das in dem Passagenprojekt, das lesen wir in Konvolut K, hat Benjamin eine Theorie der ineinandergreifenden Achsen der ontogenetischen und phylogenetischen Entwicklung aufgestellt, wobei das Erwachen der Kinder aus dem Traumstadium der Jugend rechtwinklig, so könnte man sagen, zum Erwachen des menschlichen Kollektivs aus dem Traumstadion der Geschichte steht. Und da wäre die Frage, auch wenn wir uns dann im Radio befinden, gibt es denn in welchem Erwachen befinden wir uns dann eigentlich, wenn Benjamin sich ja auch da den Scherz erlaubt hat, sich zu überlegen, wie ist, dass man ja nicht wirklich gesehen werden kann und so weiter. Also wie kann man dieses Rechtwinklige verstehen, dieses aus dem Traumstadium der Jugend erwachen?
Well, this idea of an ontogenetic and phylogenetic crossing, quite frankly, I don't think that's involved in an actual radio transmission. They seem to be much more direct, and I think a lot of the programs were very political.
Yeah.
That he had a way of being able to tell stories to children, and he says at one point that in case there are some avakshana who have hid themselves in between
yeah.
children listening or something, and then he makes some sort of comment to them.
Yeah.
It's I think it's very Brechtian what he does.
Yeah.
Radio. The
yeah.
most Brechtian practice, let's say, is his radio Sendung.
Yeah.
This other aspect, this Traum and Erwachen vom Traum, that could be an extremely elaborate theory.
Yeah.
The relationship of ontogenesis to phylogenesis. And yet, I think if we belabor that much, we'll miss what is perhaps more important. There's this little piece that he has called Traumkitsch, and it talks about how we can't help but having this kind of deep attachment to the objects of our childhood. And when those objects are kitschy, well, it's too bad. That's what we're attached.
Yeah.
I think he's actually talking about this kind of embarrassing truth that when you hear a song, like a stupidest popular song that was popular when you were 12 years old or 14 years old, it can move you to tears.
Yeah.
I mean, that you have this affective engagement
yeah.
in popular culture
yeah.
Of the most kitschy or culture industry type.
Yeah.
And that there's an enormous affective power there
yeah.
that needs to be recognized, because if it's not recognized by the person who has it, if it's disparaged as not intellectual enough or too childish, then it can come back in an unconscious way when you're older and lead to affective response, politically very dangerous.
Yeah. Ja, und da kommen wir auch zu dieser Frage, gibt es denn eine Beziehung dann auch, die in den letzten Radiosendungen dann offensichtlicher wurde, diese verborgenen Warnungen, die Benjamin formulierte, als die Luft kaum mehr zum Atmen war, in den letzten Jahren dann von Weimar vor dem Umschlagen eben den Faschismus, als Benjamins Erzählungen auch politisch theologisch wurden. Gibt es da eine Beziehung zu Ihrer aktuellen Veröffentlichung Thinking Past Terror, Islamism and Critical Theory on the Left? Yeah, because you started with 9/11 and that has to do with a change really and radicalization of Islamic groups and their, and in a way, terror. So how would you say what is... Was schlägt gerade um? Schlägt gerade etwas um?
In diesem Moment?
Ja.
Yeah.
In that moment? Probably, or the last 3 years?
Well, yes, I think that 9/11 was a watershed. I think it was a watershed. Not that I used to understand much better than I do today how the Europeans would say, oh, you know, it happened to you, the United States, that's why you think it's so important. It's not so important. But I think it was important in a way that other kinds of terrorism have not been. And I'm, in other words, let me just put it this way. I think the first feeling that you have is the whole situation is a repetition of those other moments where fear of the enemy has produced authoritarianism at home.
Ja, Chris Mann, zum Schluss. Ja, dieses Gespräch auch jetzt mit dem Bezug Islam und Terrorismus werden wir in einer Sendung, in einer Universalsendung am 7. August fortsetzen. Dazu gibt es auch Informationen im Internet, auch über diese Axiom-Sendung unter www.fehe.org und da kann man sich weiter über dieses Gespräch informieren. Ja, die schlechte Qualität dieses der Leitung nach Amerika bitte ich auch hier zu entschuldigen. Das ist manchmal nicht wirklich vorauszusehen, wie gut dann die Aufnahmequalität wird. Ja, am Ende dieser Axiom-Sendung verabschiedet sich jetzt hier am Mikrofon von den verehrten Unsichtbaren da draußen Felicia Herrschaft und ich bedanke mich bei denen, die die Sendung mit vorbereitet haben, nämlich Michele Salonia und José Romero, Emanuel Romero und Renata Martins. Die nächste Axiom-Sendung wird am 23. August hier auf Radio X von 14 bis 16 Uhr laufen. Und wer sich auch noch an dieser Sendung beteiligen möchte, kann sich auch darüber gerne hier im Büro bei Radio X informieren oder auch über das Internet. Ja, jetzt noch Chris Mann und Monteverdi. Bis dann.
Die Hostage in der Skyclap. People you talk to were 33 times more likely to be your moralized until you don't talk to them. The guns.